following interview with Bob Talbot took place on November 21st, 1985. The interview is part of a joint effort between the Columbia University Oral History Project and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
Born and raised?
Well, I was born in Pittsburgh, but I was raised mainly in Wisconsin and Illinois because I come from an Illinois family. And grew up in public schools in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, outside of Milwaukee, and then University of Illinois, class of 1936.
Mm-hmm. So you did a BA?
I did two BAs, one liberal arts and just not political science, the other in journalism.
Mm-hmm. After you graduated from college, what was your, how did you make a living?
I went to work for Discovery Data News as a cub reporter.
And you were there through the 30s or through the late 30s?
I was there a couple of years. And then I got a chance at a fellowship that took me ultimately to India. And I began my India studies in 1938 for the year in England at the Indian Civil Service Probationer's Place. And then 2 years in India, one on the Muslim side, another on the Hindu side.
Were you at a university there? Or?
In my Muslim year, I was half the year at the university and half the year in a village in Kashmir. On the Hindu side, I was mainly in ashrams and some urban settings.
Then World War II came along, you served in the...
Served in the Navy, in Bombay for 2 years, in Chongqing for 2 years. And back in Washington, and then I went right back to the Chicago Daily News and became their correspondent in South Asia, Southeast Asia, at the time of the transfer of power from Britain to India and the partition of India.
Were you took your duties in the Navy?
Navy liaison officer Bombay and assistant naval attaché in Chongqing.
Okay. And then after the war, you were back with the Daily News in India. From then, how long were you with the Daily News again?
A couple of years until the new independent nations of India and Pakistan were established. And then I went back to Chicago and took a doctorate at the University of Chicago in international relations. And then got involved in founding an inter-university organization called the American Universities Field Staff, which was really an academic foreign service. American, mainly scholars who were specialists in foreign areas, studying and writing on those areas and returning to the campuses of the sponsoring universities for periods of lecture and so on.
Mm-hmm. Was funded American scholars going overseas?
Yes, that's right.
So it was very broad gauge.
Very broad.
Was it like a privately funded or?
Funded mainly by the universities that were members, corporate members, and by foundations.
What was your position with this?
The executive director of it for 10 years.
Did that, was it mostly third world oriented or all just?
Largely, we didn't call it third world, we call it those parts of the world that are least known to Americans.
So, and you were with that through the 50s?
That's right. Until I was invited into government at the beginning of the 1960s.
How did it come about that you were appointed as a Secretary of State for Air Eastern?
I'm not entirely sure, but my belief is that because I was known to both Dean Rusk and Chet Bowles, they were the ones who put up my name. The people in the White House had never heard of me. I knew that.
Did you know Russ through his Rockefeller Foundation?
That's correct, yes.
Actually,
we had met briefly in India during World War II when he was a colonel out there. And I'd known Bowles also in India.
During the wartime period?
Not during the wartime, when he first became ambassador in 1950, just right.
So they helped bring you in, basically, by their influence. When you became Assistant Secretary, what were your general responsibilities?
18 countries, 6 of divided the world into 5 different regional areas, and mine extended from the Eastern Arab countries and Israel through Turkey, Iran, and Afghanistan, the subcontinent right to Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka.
How did the division run on a sort of day-to-day basis? How did it work in a certain practice? Did you meet with best officers constantly, or how did the work process occur?
Yes. Obviously, foreign policy brings in a number of different elements. Within the State Department, the geographic bureaus had primary responsibility for developing programs and policies and maintaining relationships with our embassies and consulates in the area and with those governments. But the work of the geographic bureaus always interrelated with the functional bureaus, like Bureau of Economic Affairs and so on, that had global oversight. And in addition, of course, we were responsible for liaison with AID, with agriculture, with commerce, with treasury, with the Pentagon, other governmental agencies. And we reported essentially to what's called in the State Department the seventh floor, the secretary and the undersecretaries.
Do you refer directly to Russ, or did you encounter secretaries more often than you dealt with Russ?
It depended on the level of concern about a particular area at a particular time. Russ was the secretary for much of the period. George Ball was the undersecretary. And then there were others. I dealt primarily with those two while they were there. I reported primarily to those two.
Who did you rely upon for advice and information when it came to Iranian issues? Who were the main people you worked with when it came to decisions on Iran at this time?
On a day-to-day basis, the Iran desk was at the point of all advice organizations and our consultations. All copies of telegrams from the embassy in Iran were received by me, often by the secretary, but particularly by the Iran desk. When the telegram would refer to something that was of an earlier period that I wasn't familiar with, or in some depth that I wasn't familiar with, it was normally the Iran desk that to which I turned for information. However, the pattern broadened very rapidly and very widely on this, because AID, as it now is, and the other agencies had very strong interests in Iran. And so we would have different levels of meetings constantly to be sure that there was a coordinated U.S. government position on the issues that came up.
Did Marshall go to the NSC? Was that sort of like coordinating focus for our lesson?
There was an NSC representative, Robert Comer, who sat in on the interagency talks that we had. We'd try, sometimes once a week, to have a luncheon that included the half a dozen people that were most involved around the government in this case, Iran. It could have been Israel, it could have been Turkey or any other country in the region. And usually, most of these people at the weekly luncheon had responsibilities for the same general a variety of people. I mentioned Comer. Bill Gaud of AID was a considerable factor. There would be different people from Pentagon, but usually it was somebody from ISA, International Security Affairs. who was there. There'd be an agency man there, usually a man, carrier woman. USIA would have somebody there, but that would change too. The lists are available, but Liz didn't. Treasury was much interested, although I don't remember a very senior person in Treasury participating in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Who's the country desk person at this point? Do you remember the name of the person?
Well, Robert Miner was the head of what we call GTI, which was Greece, Turkey, Iran. And he was at the next level down, reported to me, from those three countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had assistants dealing with each of the countries.
Specialist,
yes. He was a specialist. There was a woman named Catherine Bracken, who was one of his specialists. There were several others who were at various stages of seniority and who ultimately became more and more responsible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they became desk officers.
Was this task force the first major Iran issue that came up when you were Assistant Secretary?
Yes.
Some of the issues, the concerns that led to its formation, what inspired it?
I think basically it was a sense that 7 or 8 years had passed since the Shah's return, that there were concerns about the direction in which Iran was going, and about our relationships with him. The Shah was pressing for more aid. We needed a coordinated U.S. government position on this. The different elements of the government were not agreeing at the beginning of that administration. There's been a very vigorous involvement with Iran during the Eisenhower administration. We're starting with the return of the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
There was a feeling that we needed to look at what American interests in Iran really were. And get, as they say, our ducks in order. And this was this was really it. There's an effort to get agreement in the U.S. government on what Iran's real needs were. As usual, the differences between those who thought that military aid was the best solution and those who thought that economic and social development were more important. There were concerns already about what we now call human rights there. Questions as to whether the U.S. was supporting things going on in Iran that it didn't really care for, and so on. So all these questions came up. It was an examination of the Iranian situation that set the tone, I think, for the next year or two. Although I have to add that later, Ambassador Holmes felt that we've been too doctrinaire, if you will, too much concerned about somebody else's economic and social cultural problems, and not enough concerned about sustaining the Shah as an important feature in this region.
The report that I read that was by John Bowling, who was involved in these issues apparently, suggested that there was some concern in early 61 that the Shah might drift into sort of a neutralist posture. Was that why we felt concern at that time? Or?
That was a part of it.
Yeah.
And was part of the argument for involving in more in terms of military assistance and duty. I'd have to say that at the beginning of the 60s, the U.S. government wanted to have good, solid relations with the Shah, but was not prepared to make him a surrogate in the region. I think from 72 onwards it changed quite substantially.
When the task force was set up and was considering the issue of Iran, what kind of policy options did it consider? Do you recall any of them? What would be the best approach to take?
I think I've indicated that there were those who argued in favor of essentially a military-based relationship, that the primary concerns were security concerns. But as far as the United States' interest in Iran went, and the importance of the Persian Gulf was pointed out and all the rest of it, there were others who felt that the internal strength and stability of Iran depended upon the Shah's relationship to his own people, on modernization and development programs, and that side of the picture. There was some considerable concern about the human rights situation in Iran.
I guess what I meant to say is that, if we talk about Boeing, what I've seen suggested that he laid out like several options in terms of support of the Shah. One was to maybe support the national front types, give them more political support, or support a conservative military group, or support the Shah, support the Shah, expand American support for the Shah as a central focus of Iranian politics, or just to continue the existing policy of trying to get them to liberalize a little bit. Were those options laid out that?
Well, I thought that paper was circulated.
And
Berlin was in part doing his own thinking, mm-hmm. and in part expressing the views of different groups. So he was personally involved, but also repertorially involved.
Mm-hmm. It was like sort of a think piece that he worked on.
Right.
Was there like real serious discussion, say, supporting the National Front as opposed to the Shah, or was that ever actually brought up as an option?
Everything was discussed.
Yeah.
And the question of whether the Shah could survive, given the course he was taking, what would happen if the Shah were to disappear by whatever reasons, health, assassination, whatever. These were all discussed. I don't have the papers in front of me, but I understand that somebody has gotten them under freedom of information.
Apparently some of them are. Not all of them, though. Some documents have been. Some of them are, they're sanitized in parts, so you really can't tell what the considerations were discussed were. What were the task force final recommendations to the extent that you can remember them?
But Julius Holmes was sent out with a brief to encourage the Shah to open up the system somewhat, to get more public involvement in public life, to look to cultural and economic advances, but not to undermine the Shah, or to encourage real alternatives. In other words, the Shah remained the force and the influence with which we were dealing.
Now, when officials discuss Iran at this point, early 1961 or so, how important was Iran as a country to Kennedy administration officials, how what its value was, what kind of interests did they have there, how did they conceive their interests in Iran, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, it was definitely important. The task force was set up only because it was regarded as important. It was the first task force set up during the Kennedy administration for that part of the world. There wasn't any task force at that time for Israel or for the Arab states or for the subcontinent or anything else. So it was regarded as key. And the reasons were multiple. The Baghdad Pact had only recently run into severe trouble and been converted into center. The oil industry was of great significance in the recovery of Europe and Japan, and also in terms of world fuel supplies. Prices were low then, of course, we didn't know it, but as compared to the later times, it was certainly low. The potential for difficulties in the Gulf region were strong. Immediately after the British ended their responsibility for Kuwait, Iraq made moves which the Kuwaitis interpreted as threatening, trying to take it over. There were problems with the Kurds, who of course live in Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, and so they affected all three. There was a sharp awareness that any serious difficulty in the Persian Gulf would have global repercussions.
Now, was there a concern at this time, back to the task force deliberation, was there a concern that the Shah's position was sort of basically unstable, or was there, how concerned were they about the stability of the situation in Iran? At that time.
Well, that's where one of the differences
appeared.
There were those who felt that he was firmly in control, mm-hmm. and others who felt that the students, some other groups, were really not under his control, and that instability was definitely possible. This was one of the issues discussed.
So you said Holmes was recommended to take instructions to go to the Shah and try to bolster his position in some way, or get him to reform a bit?
Well, the end of the feeling was that our posture should be one of encouraging the Shah to look to reforms that seem to us important. And to work actively to broaden the system of government, the support for government, so that the instability would be decreased.
How responsive was the Shah to Holmes' suggestions at that point?
In a way, fairly responsive. Among the American ambassadors in Iran after the 1953 period, Holmes was almost the last who could have a semi-avuncular relationship with the Shah. He was senior, he was experienced, the Shah was young, he'd been back in power only 8 years. Afterwards, we sent ambassadors who did not have that kind of seniority relationship with the Shah at all. And the relationship to the American ambassador changed substantially. Now, it went up and down. Some of our ambassadors have been more influential than the Shah than otherwise. But Mary Rampaster dealt with a Shah who had greater self-confidence and determination to do what he wanted to. Holmes, I really was able to talk with the Shah on a quite open basis. And it was about this time that the Shah decided to go ahead with an active development program, the so-called White Revolution, or People's Revolution, as they call it sometimes, in order to get more economic development more broadly. Although I don't think he was terribly responsive in such things as the role of Savak. The single-minded control of any sort of agitation, nor was he able, apparently, to stamp out evidences of corruption, including perhaps on that basis.
Apparently one move the Shah made, I guess in the year 61, was he appointed Ali Amini, Prime Minister. This move made in response to American pressure. I got some impression that there was some U.S. pressure, but it's not clear to me. That's part of it.
I never know how to define American pressure or no pressure.
Yeah.
Clearly, we felt and conveyed to the Shah that we thought a more moderate-minded, vigorous prime minister would be helpful than these goals, which we were talking about, which with which he agreed in his discussions. We were encouraged by the appointment of the prime I don't think, I'm not aware, and I certainly don't remember that we were ever crass enough to say to him, look, this is the man for you to put in.
Later on, he made some kind of accusatory statements about what happened at that point, but it's hard to evaluate them, you would say. But I remember hearing someone suggested to me at one point that he had given some special assistance, foreign aid, a grant or something like that, in order to make the decision. But it's not clear whether that was exactly.
You know, this issue of the hidden foreign hand comes up in country after country. And normally speaking, or often enough, a decision that's unpopular with some element of within a country or not is ascribed to American pressure as a way of making it accepted. Whereas, in fact, it frequently is the decision of the local leader that, for generalized reasons, perhaps including questions of aid availability and such, he needs to make some moves, and this is these moves he's going to make. We thought of that as a constructive move.
One document that I saw suggested that officials hoped that the appointment of a meeting would sort of turn the Shah into more of a constitutional monarch. So he had the regulars of a prime minister who would have major authority in the country. Was that talked about at that point?
It was certainly talked about on the ground that stability would be strengthened in the country if there were broader participation in public processes and government. And I think that there was a feeling in Washington at that time that the concept of the all-powerful monarch was not going to survive forever.
Did you talk about these questions with Rusk, the Shah and Amini at this point, or no, early 61? Did you discuss these things with him at any length? Or?
Regularly reported to him on the deliberations of the task force, and he would have reactions to them. I don't know that I'd characterize these as long discussions, but certainly he was kept informed all the time. And I, all the time, had an impression of his own reactions to what we were doing.
Did he have any special input that he made into the policy?
Only in these comments that he would make that I would think about and then carry back to the group.
Did you ask him about Kennedy's position? President Kennedy's position was towards these matters. Did you ever talk about it or meet with them and other officials?
I recall meeting with him fewer times on Iran than on several other issues that came up during that period. The NSC representative who spoke for Mac Fundy and presumably for the president was a very active participant. Sometimes he was expressing his own views, and sometimes he was relaying attitudes in the White House.
This is Comer.
And we usually had a pretty good idea which was which.
Well, this is the point, though, when the State Department's views had some primacy in the policymaking process. I mean, was there the NSC have a strong influence? The NSC advisor, Fundy, did he have a strong influence in policymaking? Was he more?
My relations with Comer, and with Mac Fundy, but especially Comer, who was sort of given charge in our area, were open and frank, candid. Sometimes we agreed, sometimes we disagreed. He presented his views vigorously because he's a vigorous person, and I would present our summations. I don't recall any occasion when they really overruled us. Especially in that task force period when we were meeting very frequently on Iran. The point was to get to some kind of consensus, and we usually managed.
When Amini became Prime Minister, I guess, May or June of 61, was there any effort to sort of work with him and give him special support in preparing a reform program of some sort? Was it with Holmes encouraged to,
Yes, indeed. And he was treated as Prime Minister. This didn't mean that Holmes stopped seeing the Shah, or stopped discussing great strategic issues with the Shah, and so on and so on. But a fair amount of the day-to-day business, which had to do with aid programs, which had to do with positions to be taken in international bodies, all sorts of things were done with it.
Did State Department officials have some sort of view of what they would hope maybe he could accomplish, or a specific view of what they would have liked him to accomplish? Did they talk about things that they think would be useful for him to do, or was it much more indirect than that? Or
you mean in terms of specific policies? The answer is yes, there were certain things. In the aid program, for example, we were very much interested in institution building and infrastructure building. Rather urged the Iranian government to pursue those lines, as indeed that government did reasonably well in some areas. Similarly, we would argue and urge in favor of certain positions at the UN or in the regional organizations or something of that sort. So that was done. Obviously, our posture was the benefits of an opening up of political, social, and economic activities.
I had the impression that during this period, Walt Rostow, among others, I suppose, was trying to encourage countries like Iran to develop a sort of pro-Western middle class that would sort of as a better opportunity stability in these countries like Iran. Would that, talk about or discuss as sort of like a goal or a purpose of
yes.
American aid policy, I suppose? Or,
Walt's influence was, of course, very strong in the thinking of the administration. Take up the loan and all of that. But the concept of a middle class that would have a vested interest in a more open society was certainly there.
Now, when it came to foreign aid decisions, did you take part in like discussions of allocations of aid, like size of the shares of aid that would go to countries like Iran and other Middle Eastern countries? Was that one of those?
Oh, yes.
Did the size of allocations become an issue in U.S.-Iran relations? Were there complaints about we would like more money than this, or this is not enough? Or was this ever a problem, or was it?
I can't think of a single country where that kind of discussion didn't go on all the time. This was an administration that was focusing very heavily on growth and development around the world, particularly the poorer countries. And that very fact encouraged a lot of these countries to press for substantial aid increases, and then these requests rapidly got beyond resources. The debates came in Washington as to the size of the aid package for a particular country, and the split between military and economic aid. Then the debate went on to particular types of programs. Should housing be a major priority, or roads, and so on. The aid debate was carried on at all levels of government, starting, I guess, with the desks, the country desks, in state and aid and Pentagon, especially, sometimes others, and then going to the assistant secretary level, where it really was a main feature, and in that really it was AID, Pentagon, and the NSC working with me that tried to hammer out decisions. We didn't often have to send disputed positions to the NSC officially. Occasionally it would happen.
It was done formally, usually. Did the AID, I guess the State Department, when I worked with the AID, did they try to induce the Iranians to make like internal reforms like financial stability, financial stabilization programs? And was that part of the effort? Was that ever successful? Was that difficult to carry through? It was difficult to influence other countries' financial fiscal policies. And how was that? In the case of Iran, was that successful or difficult to accomplish?
Iran, of course, as an oil producer, didn't have the kinds of problems that countries like India had. And therefore, it was a different sort of situation in Iran. Even as early as the early 60s, we thought the Shah was pushing for greater oil revenues as a way of getting more resources. Now the questions that we had in the early 60s, as I recall them, had to do more with the integrity of the financial process, the quality of the system that levied taxes. This has been this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Trying to get to the modernize our tax system, yep, and so forth. Now, in order to induce a shot, I made internal reforms. The administration make any assurances as to his military security requirements? Was it ever assurances made that we'll give you certain military aid if you proceed to reform, or is that ever? That's probably, I thought you'd probably get two.
Yeah, it was a bargaining doesn't usually come in that simply.
Yeah.
Usually every decision is reserved till the end. Mm-hmm. And the petitioner, if he is a petitioner, knows that if he doesn't give on some things, he's unlikely to get much on other things. Mm-hmm. And this was really more the pattern. The Shah knew that there were elements in Washington that were resisting a substantial increase in military assistance, on the grounds that more military assistance would begin to skew his public finances, because of the local costs and everything.
I think you might recall some members of the Senate, such as William Fulbright and Hubert Humphrey, were very critical of the military aid programs in Iran. There have been hearings that were published recently that suggested that that was very dangerous implications. Do you recall how did the administration respond to those kinds of criticisms? How did they try to mollify senatorial critics, like Fulbright?
Well, a number of us went up to testify on the Hill.
Uh-huh.
On the military side, there were two or three different arguments. One, we were continuing in general to support the Northern Tier concept of assistance to Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan as part of our regional posture. And this was before satellites, and therefore at a time when our ability to monitor Soviet missile and other developments depended upon stations that we had in those Northern Tier countries. And the Department of Military Assistance was necessary in order to provide the climate to keep those stations operating. And the second argument was that we too were concerned about over-militarization, but we felt that the proposed amounts struck a balance, and that the executive branch looked at this very carefully and had concluded that the amounts requested would be a reasonable balance between military and economic aid.
Let me just turn this over.